I'm Mark Purcell, and this is Cincinnati Edition. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author Doris Kearns Goodwin is coming to town tomorrow night for a lecture at the School for the Creative and Performing Arts, co-sponsored by Joseph Beth Booksellers and the Cincinnati Museum Center. She'll be discussing her new book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Doris Kearns Goodwin is joining me on the phone for a conversation and to answer your questions. You can call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Doris, welcome to Cincinnati Edition, and thanks for taking
the
time.
Thank you. Very glad to be with you.
Well, as I've heard your interviews and seen your appearances about this book recently, there's been a big focus on Theodore Roosevelt and his relationship to the press, but I'm sitting here in the Queen City of the Midwest, Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'd like to focus on William Howard Taft and the role he played in both the book and politics at the time. You spent 7 years researching this book. What did you discover about our Cincinnati son?
Well, what most interested me when I first started to study Teddy Roosevelt 7 years ago was to find out that the friendship between Roosevelt and Taft was much deeper and more emotional than I had understood. 400 letters exchanged between the two. They met when they were really in their early 30s. They're both in Washington. Taft is Solicitor General. Roosevelt is the Civil Service Commissioner, and they lived near each other in that part of Washington, walked to work together, had dinners together, and then kept up not only a correspondence but a friendship. They both were kind of young reformers fighting against the corruption of the age and fighting against some of the robber barons, and they felt allied in that way. So from then on, I just decided I better study this guy Taft, and I found him a much more empathetic, interesting and an honorable person than I had known so little about him, and I liked being with him for all these years.
So you began with Roosevelt, and William Howard Taft just happened to pop up numerous times along the way.
And then, yes, I knew I wanted to study the Progressive Era, which would essentially be going from 1900 to 1912. So I knew that there was this dramatic rupture between the two of them when they ran against each other in 1912, but I hadn't realized that in 1908, when Taft wins the presidency, that Teddy was almost like his campaign manager, you know, constantly giving him advice, handpicking him as his successor, telling him, don't play golf, it looks like a rich man's game, fight against William Jennings Bryan, attack him, smile, you beloved man, you look so great when you're smiling. And then when I saw that, I went back to his role as Secretary of War, Taft, in Teddy's cabinet, and saw that he had been his chief advisor, indeed, whenever Roosevelt went away on his hunting trips or train trips around the country, he would just simply say to the press, oh, don't worry, Taft is sitting on the lid. Then, of course, these huge cartoons of this big Taft sitting on a lid. So, and then there were so many letters that Taft wrote to his wife, Nellie. Nellie became such an interesting figure in my own mind and hopefully in the book. And then he wrote to his brothers all the time. So that's the treasure of a historian, to have that written word. And it was there in troves for William Howard Taft and his relatives.
Well, they Tafts had, you know, quite a history in being part of the history of Cincinnati. And I know you visited Cincinnati to dig into Taft and his background. But what did you find and where did you work here in town?
Well, what was so much fun was a friend of mine who's a rabbi in Cincinnati, Gary Zola, took me around, and he knew his city, of course, Cincinnati. So we went to Taft's house, and just to see that house, it makes such a difference when you can see the place where one of the people you're writing about was born. And it was a rather large house, I mean, bigger than I would have imagined. And I'd seen a picture of it before then, but just to walk through the rooms and imagine him being in those rooms, and then being able to go to the now Art Museum, which was his brother Charlie's house, which was right up the street from where Nellie had grown up, and she always looked at that big mansion, you know, with longing. And then I saw the house where the two of them actually lived when they were married before he went to Washington. And the Cincinnati Historical Society had lots of records. So altogether, it just made you feel what it might have been like to be young in Cincinnati. When Nellie and Taft fell in love with each other, she would have these salons at her house, which were literary salons. The people had to come, all of her friends, having read books. And then they discussed them, and it's so fun. In Taft's letters, he'll say, he's in the library, he's catching up, he's doing it at the last minute, he wants to do good for Nellie. So I pictured their romance when they were young, and watched them, you know, grow together. He came back there when he was president and had been nominated for the ceremony. He came back there again, the election. So Cincinnati was huge in this story.
It did play quite a role, and it was fascinating to learn so much more. I'm sitting just down the hill, if you may, from the Taft House, and having seen it numerous times, for you to bring the history into that house and into our city was fascinating. And learning how progressive, you talked about wanting to write about the progressives, how progressive Nellie was, his wife and supporter and a real woman about town.
No, absolutely. I mean, young Nellie grew up wanting something in her life to be expansive, more than simply getting married and having children. And her brothers were sent to Harvard and Yale, but her father wasn't going to have higher education for her. So she just really rebelled against those restrictions on a woman. She started teaching in a boys' school, vowed she would not marry, but then, of course, meeting young Will Taft, who not only adored her but promised her that they would be partners and that he would respect her independence. And it was really Nellie's desire and love of politics more than his that got him to move from being a judge in Cincinnati to Solicitor General, eventually to the Governor Generalship of the Philippines, where she made a real mark. I mean, she was an activist first lady there. She sterilized milk for young kids, saved a lot of people's lives. As first lady of the United States, she also was concerned with working women. She opened the guest lists of the White House to more people than ever before. She created a municipal park with free concerts. And she brought the cherry trees, of course, to Washington. But she was a really extraordinary figure, way ahead of her time, I think. And I found her relationship with him so fascinating.
Doris Kearns Goodwin on Cincinnati Edition. She'll be in town tomorrow night for a lecture at the School for the Creative and Performing Arts, co-sponsored by Joseph Beth Booksellers and the Cincinnati Museum Center. Her new book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. And it's very interesting throughout this book to see, as you related, how Theodore Roosevelt could really use the bully pulpit, use the press to his advantage. And for William Howard Taft, that just wasn't quite the case. He didn't quite have that touch. That bigger than life, even though Taft was bigger than life, that bigger than life personality that Roosevelt had.
No, I think that's right. I think that's really the major difference between them. It wasn't that Taft betrayed Roosevelt's progressive legacy. It was more that once he got into the presidency on his own right, he had always been happy being the number two person. And he was great as Secretary of War, as Governor General, as Solicitor General. But then in that office itself, when you have to then deal with the press and use your speaking ability to mobilize the public. As a judge all of his life before this, that's where his temperament was. You know, when you make a decision as a judge, you don't have to explain it. It explains itself. So even as president, he later admitted when, I think in like 1914, he gave a series of lectures, and he said he knew that was the one place he'd been derelict. He felt proud of the decisions he made, which he should, because he did a lot of antitrust suit. He actually preserved a lot of land for conservation, but didn't know how to trumpet himself in a certain sense. And he admitted that he'd been derelict in the use of the bully pulpit. And that's what Teddy, of course, was so brilliant at. It would have been hard for anybody to follow Roosevelt. And even without the difference in their personalities, it would have been hard because the rupture in the Republican Party was beginning to form even under Roosevelt's time, with the progressives becoming stronger and the conservative old guard fighting back. So that was going to belittle anybody who came into office, I think. But in Taft's case, it just was made doubly hard, not only by his problems not comfortable, I guess is the way to say, dealing with the press, but his wife Nellie has a stroke 2 months into his presidency, never is able to speak in a connected way again. Absolutely devastating to him. He loved her so much. She was the person, as he said, he would always turn to if something went tough in politics. And she might have made a real difference. She already had as First Lady in the course of his administration. We forget that those private turmoils can affect public duties in such enormous ways.
And it did seem that he missed that spark that she had in giving him a little bit of a spark, at least from what I've read in the bully pulpit. But I also wanted to know about William Howard Taft and his love of the court, because he turned down the first opportunity to be a Supreme Court justice, holding out. Nellie really wanted him to become president, but he was really aiming more for the court than the presidency.
No, there's no question about that. The first two times that Roosevelt offered him the Supreme Court position, he was in the Philippines, and he was really beloved there. I mean, the interesting thing is that Roosevelt once said of Taft, "I almost envy somebody with Taft's personality. People love him at first sight. He was kindly. He was open to the Filipino people. And when he was thought he was leaving, they just demonstrated, we don't want you to go. So he stayed in the Philippines. Then he came back as Secretary of War when he could still have authority over the Philippines. And once again, Teddy offered it to him. But by then, he was already on the track in many people's minds to be president and turned it down. And I think, you know, it's such an interesting moment in history. I think he would have been happier had he chosen it then. He finally, in 1921, in the last decade of his life, gets appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and said it was the happiest day of his life. And he at least had that last decade doing the thing he'd always wanted to do from the time he was a little boy. I was so glad that happened for him.
Doris Kearns Goodwin talking about the bully pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the golden age of journalism. If you have a question for Doris or a comment, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. And Gary did pass along a question. He said President Obama has said he views Teddy Roosevelt's influencing him in his presidency. Do you see any evidence of that?
Well, I think that, you know, he went out, Obama did, to Kansas, where Roosevelt made a famous speech called the New Nationalism Speech. And he deliberately talked about, you know, what it was that the government had as responsibilities to its people. And I think he also, in these last, you know, at the time of this last election in 2012, realizing that there was just deadlock in Washington, he said he had to bring the public's interest to bear on Washington through the bully pulpit more than he had in his first term. And, of course, Teddy was the one who defined the word bully pulpit, who also had old guard in charge of the congressional committees, not willing to bring a lot of bills to the floor that he wanted to see passed. And the only way he could do that was to get the press and himself to push the public to pressure from the outside in. And I think that's when Obama began to think about Teddy Roosevelt somewhat more, when he saw that that path toward change comes from the outside in rather than the inside out.
I was struck on more than one occasion while reading the bully pulpit and how much we're doomed to repeat history, because it seems that there are a lot of similarities and parallels with what was happening a century or so ago with what's happening today. You know, what lesson do you feel we can learn to prevent ourselves from, you know, doing the same thing all over again?
No, it really is interesting. I mean, maybe it's because my books just take so long that history repeats itself by the time I'm done. But it is true that the Industrial Revolution created a different economy for the United States in the 1890s and 1900s, where you had a much bigger gap between the rich and the poor than we'd ever seen before, where you had mergers and acquisitions creating these huge monopolies, where people felt that time was speeding up so much because of all the new inventions of telephone, et cetera, et cetera. And then the technological age that we've been through in these last decades has done a similar thing by creating that gap between the rich and the poor, and the middle class being squeezed and small business feeling squeezed out. So the answer to the Gilded Age, which was that situation at the turn of the 20th century, was what Teddy Roosevelt introduced, which was progressive, at least using the government to soften the aspects of industrialism, workers being exploited in the factories and no maximum hours, no minimum wages, no workmen's compensation, something about antitrust to begin to break up some of these big corporations, and legislation to get corporations out of public financing for government, for elections. All of those were the responses, in a certain sense, to the situation that we're facing now. The problem now is probably twofold. I don't know if the bully pulpit has the same power it did then, with our attention span being so limited. My muckraker guys would write these wonderful, really fact-based stories about Standard Oil or the railroad abuses or the corruption in the cities. People would gobble them up, and they would be 20, 30, 40,000 words long and would become part of the common conversation. I don't know whether our attention span has it, whether you could have that kind of impact with the press today that we once did. And the bully pulpit itself, you know, even when a president gives a speech now, the pundits are tearing it down before he's finished. You're watching your own cable network, and it may be that it doesn't have the power it once had.
And is that an issue when it comes to the politicking? Because you see a lot of, well, negative press, as you say, people tearing it apart, whether it be a speech or a television commercial or the like. You know, has the attention span been reduced so much that does make it a very difficult proposition for using the bully pulpit to an advantage?
No, I think so. I mean, when I think about Roosevelt's time, when he would make a speech, it would be carried in full in the newspapers, and, you know, obviously he garnered headlines as well, but it would become the speech when he would give an important moment. Similarly, when FDR is in office and radio has taken some, you know, part of the power in terms of communication, when he's on those radio addresses, fireside chats, 80% of the adult audience is listening. Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street on a hot Chicago night, not miss a word of what he was saying because everybody was listening. And then in the early days of television, really up from JFK to Reagan, if a president gave a speech, it would be recorded in full. Then they go back to their ordinary programming, only three networks, everybody's watching it. And now, as I say, you might just be watching your favorite network. You might never hear the full speech. And if somebody interrupts the speech, as sometimes happened, that becomes the story. Once we start talking about some problem, then something breaking news comes in, you know, within 2 days later. So it's hard to keep that sustained interest that's necessary for the public to really have an impact on political life.
Well, and outside of political life, too, I think I made you or I heard you make a comment earlier. It may have been on the Diane Rehm show talking about what you were just saying, a shorter news cycle where there might be a headline story, but it's only a headline for 3 days, and then it kind of disappears. I kind of
I
see that happening
right.
with the typhoon in the
right.
Philippines
I mean,
right now.
All of a sudden, you care deeply about something, and then something else takes its place. It's interesting because even at the turn of the 20th century, when they thought everything was speeding up so much, there were nervous disorders they reported all over the country because suddenly, you know, international horrors were becoming local news. You were finding out about all these things that were happening in the world. And, you know, and people were feeling like country life had been replaced by city life, and the solace of the country was no longer giving you that sense of rhythm of nature and all the jarring sounds of the city. And they said, all this thing was speeding. Think about the speeding today up of life compared to 1900 with exponential. We must have nervous disorders all over the place.
Right. Well, William Howard Taft never seemed to be one who was nervous. As a matter of fact, in your accounts, from the time he was a young boy right through his president, for the most part, he was well-liked, that he was always there with a smile and a friendly type. It didn't seem there was a mean bone in his body. Did you find anything to the contrary where he was a little more competitive, a little more tiger-like in any aspect of his life?
No, it's really interesting. I mean, his mother said when he was a little child that he smiled to anybody who would come toward him and that he did have that open, sweet nature that I think stayed with him most of the time. When he finally got into the fight with Roosevelt in 1912, of course, he felt betrayed by Roosevelt just as Roosevelt felt betrayed by him. And even though it took him a while to fight back against Roosevelt, after Roosevelt was calling him all sorts of names, you know, a fathead, with the brain of a guinea pig, which of course wasn't true. I mean, he graduated second in his class at Yale. He was very intelligent. Roosevelt knew that. But when Roosevelt got into a fight, he almost had to destroy the adversary in order to keep going. So Taft finally responded and warned people that Roosevelt, if he won this term, the third term, would want a fourth, a fifth, and democracy would be at stake. But even then, it wasn't personal. I mean, he just kept back. People wanted him to fight more personally. But he did have that kindly nature, and I think that kept him from being as effective a fighter, but it also meant that he was a really decent man.
The new book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. I'm speaking to author Doris Kearns Goodwin, who is out and around promoting the book, and she'll be in Cincinnati for a lecture tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the School for Creative and Performing Arts. You can ask her a question at 513-419-7100 or by emailing talk@wvxu.org. And that's where we got an email that asked, could Teddy Roosevelt or William Howard Taft have survived in today's 24/7 news cycle where every part of their lives would be fair game? What do you think,
that's
Doris?
That's a great question to wonder. I mean, even when I was working on Lincoln, people wondered, would Lincoln be able to be okay in this cycle? I mean, I think that Teddy would probably have been a champion at that kind of instant response. And the problem for him, he sometimes used fiery language. He might have, you know, made some mistakes on Twitter.
Yes.
Taft was more deliberative. So by the time he got his Twitter thing done, it would be 3 days later and it would no longer be a Twitter. So, I mean, I think his style was less suited for this. But what both of them at least enjoyed then was that the private lives of our public figures, their families were off limits in a way. Nobody was going to be figuring out who done something bad in somebody's past for a long period of time. The rule then was that the public, private lives were relevant only if they reflected on their public responsibilities. So the press wasn't interested in that part of it as much as in exposing the problems of the country that then could be acted upon by the leaders themselves.
I wanted to go back to Taft's wife, Nellie. I was equally intrigued in the book when you mentioned she was very happy with life in Washington, D.C., you know, a lot of activity there. And when Taft took the judgeship on the Sixth Circuit, that he expected her to be disappointed, and she was initially, but came back and really went to work here in Cincinnati and did so much. I mean, helped found the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. I just was so involved in the community here and didn't really miss a beat.
No, absolutely. No, she was a woman ahead of her time. I mean, they said even when she was young, she loved going to the beer halls in the German section of the town, you know, where she could, lots of working people would be there and they would sing, and she knew a society girl wasn't supposed to be there, but there she was. And she had gone to the White House as a little girl, and it just stuck in her mind that someday she wanted to be back there. And indeed, she'd gone to the 25th anniversary of a former president who was a friend of her father's. And then when she and Taft finally had their 25th anniversary in the White House, there was a big party, you know, remembering that earlier time. But it just seems that some people are born before the opportunities for women were as full as they might be now. She might well have been a politician in her own right had it been a different time and a different age, because she loved it. She knew how to do it. She was instinctive. I really came away with, you know, real respect for her.
513-419-7100, Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Bruce from Hyde Park is on the phone with a question for Doris Kearns Goodwin. Good afternoon, Bruce. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Ms. Goodwin. I'm enjoying your book quite a bit. And I have to admit, I haven't gotten to the end of the book, but tomorrow's the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, as you know, by Abraham Lincoln. And in Cincinnati, we have this wonderful statue in Lytle Park of Abraham Lincoln that was dedicated by William Howard Taft in 1917. I was wondering, in the course of your research, whether you did any research on the Taft dedication of the Lytle Lincoln statue that ended up being very controversial in town.
Oh, I would love to know. I'd love to know more about that. You know, what happens to me is the book essentially ends in 1912 with the terrible, turbulent contest between Taft and Teddy, and obviously both of them split the Republican vote and Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat, wins. But I did follow it further because I wanted to see if the two of them had met afterwards, and I wanted to know that Taft got to the Supreme Court. But I didn't get to that kind of a detail of 1917 statue to Lincoln. I mean, I know both Roosevelt and Taft loved Lincoln. I mean, that was the heritage of that Republican Party. But at least I was so glad to find that after lots of failed attempts to get Taft and Teddy together on the part of their friends, which Taft said was like armed neutrality, that eventually in 1918 they met in a hotel in Chicago. Taft comes into the place where Teddy is eating, goes over to him, they throw their arms around each other, and everybody in the hotel, knowing it means they've gotten together, just spontaneously applaud. And Taft later said, because Teddy dies 7 or 8 months later, that, and he goes as a private guest to the private funeral, that he would have been sad all his life if they hadn't gotten together. So when I'm looking for some sort of happy ending, it's nice when history can actually provide it.
Indeed. Well, thank you for your call, Bruce. Greatly appreciated. And we only have a moment left here, Doris, and I wanted to ask, you know, what you feel after all your research and looking into the life and times of William Howard Taft, how his presidency may have been more successful. Do you have any, had any advice for Taft?
Well, you know, I think that it actually was more successful than people thought. And I think the failure was that he just didn't feel comfortable, you know, talking. And he would wait till the last minute to prepare his speeches. Teddy would prepare his speeches months ahead of time, knowing that in a democracy, communicating with the country and your countrymen is critical. So that's the one part of it, I think, that, you know, that would have made things easier for him if he had become more at ease with the public leadership role, with the bully pulpit of the presidency, because then he could have trumpeted what he did. He might have been able to press other people to do what he wanted them to do, and it might have been very different. But even so, he had accomplished a lot more than I knew. It's just that the people didn't fully understand it at the time.
And do you think it would have benefited from Nellie not having suffered that stroke?
without a question. I mean, I think that was probably the definitive thing that changed everything, not only because she would have been such a great partner for him, but how sad he was every day. I mean, he was spending hours with her just trying to teach her how to say the word the. She could read and she could print, but somehow the voice pattern was lost, and she could only repeat phrases. She could say glad to see you if she repeated it, or I'm happy you're there, so she could stand on reception lines. But imagine losing the voice and the companionship of this person that had been the most important person in your life. They said he looked like a great stricken animal when this happened to her, and it never really got much better. So I think that had to be just a shadow over that entire presidency, and lifting that might have made so much different. Energy could have gone in a different direction.
Well, thanks for being on Cincinnati Edition, Doris. A great book and great insight into William Howard Taft and more.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to coming.
Author Doris Kearns Goodwin, she's coming to Cincinnati tomorrow for a lecture about her new book, The Bully Pulpit. The lecture, co-sponsored by Joseph Beth Booksellers and the Cincinnati Museum Center, will be at the School for Creative and Performing Arts at 7 o'clock. More details available at WVXU.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. Technical director was Bruce Ellis. Producer was Pete Breitmeyer, with help from Kevin Reynolds. You can find more about Cincinnati Edition at WVXU.org. I'm Mark Purcell. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for The Takeaway.